Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. The Atlantic has an absolutely fascinating article, not only because of the subject matter, but it also features a story about a truly fascinating man. It's titled "The Smartphone Psychiatrist." Frustrated by the failures in his field, Tom Insel, a former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, is now trying to reduce the world's anguish through the devices in people's pockets. And those devices, of course, are our smartphones. It's amazing how many people on the planet have smartphones and how many more will have them by 2020. The plan when it comes to mental health is to use smartphone powers, as the writer in The Atlantic describes, to do two things that psychiatry hasn't figured out how to do: easily detect early or even predict the onset of mental illness and quickly get effective, affordable care to those who need it. We have three guests with us for this hour. David Dobbs, who wrote the article in The Atlantic. He writes about science and culture for The Atlantic, National Geographic, and more. And he wrote a profile of Tom Insel in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. David, hello, and thank you very much. Oh, I have to make sure where you are. There you are. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating article. I don't know how you got onto this story, but it's really, really interesting. So thank you for writing it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and partially because of the person he wrote about, who is Dr. Tom Insel. He was the director of the National Institute of Mental Health from 2002 to 2015. He has worked at several other places. He did some fascinating work with prairie voles, who he discovered were monogamous, unlike most of the mammals on Earth, and what that discovery led to. But he's done some really interesting things, including graduating from high school at the age of 15 and completing his bachelor's by 17, I think. And we'll hear his life story during the course of this hour. Tom is now, working with the mental health startup, MindStrong Health, with a couple other people, and we'll hear about the work that they are doing. Tom, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you've had quite a life, Tom.
Well, I hope it's not over.
No, it's not over because we're talking on the radio. But I mean, so far, you've done really interesting things so far, I'd say. So
well, thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the air. And also joining us is David Baker. He's a doctor of clinical psychology candidate and a provisional psychologist at Monash University. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, in Melbourne, Australia. Hi, David. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. Why don't we start with you, David? This article really looks at a fascinating article, but it looks at the number of people on this planet who have cell phones, and we'll find out about the technology that allows people to do mental health with the cell phone. But this could be just because of how many of us have these. If this technology works, it could help people all over this darn world, couldn't it?
Well, this is the hope and the idea behind Tom's effort and other efforts other people are making, that the mobile phone has become ubiquitous. About 5 billion people today have them out of 7.5 billion people on Earth. And it's predicted that in another few years, by 2020, 6 billion will have smartphones. And the key distinction there, key thing about smartphones relevant here, is that a smartphone, along with getting you on the Internet, has lots of sensors that can reflect your mental health in ways that we can talk about. But the short version is, if you get depressed, for instance, it can sense changes in your behavior that you might not consciously be aware of and would be the kind of thing a mental health professional would be interested in but wouldn't know about if you're not seeing one.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is how many people can be reached by using smartphones and how many people have mental illness. I think you say in the article, 1 in 7, is that right, of the world, 7.5 billion people have mental illness, have struggled with it?
Right. You can find various estimates of this. They tend to run from between 1 in 5 or 6 and 1 in 9. We used 1 in 7, a very defensible position. And this is not any one given mental illness. Issue. It might be anxiety, it might be depression, about 1%. A smaller percentage might be suffering psychosis or its predecessor or aftermath, other things as well. So at any given time, right, about 1 in 7 of us on the globe are struggling at some level with a mental health issue. Some will pass, but often you could use help with them.
Right. Tom, I'd like for you to do just a little biography of yourself, because your life has been fascinating, and it's interesting where you are now with this cutting-edge technology. And I'd like for you to tell us, because most of our listeners would be interested in the story of how you got to here. You've done some remarkable work. You don't have to be shy about this.
It's easy, I think, to be reluctant and a little bit shy. I mean, I've had a busy career doing lots of things that weren't quite predictable, but basically I've had the luxury of being able to follow things I got interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent I trained as a psychiatrist and came out of a program that was a psychoanalytic program. Actually did a Jungian psychoanalysis in San Francisco during the day, when that was a pretty interesting way to try to understand dreams and understand many psychological processes. I ended up going into research after that, and in those days, which was in the late 70s, early 80s, we didn't really have the tools that we have today, and so many of the most interesting questions weren't really tractable. So I left psychiatry in the mid-80s and went into neuroscience, which was then a field that was really just taking off, a field that, in fact, developed the tools that we now use to be able to understand how the brain works and the connections between brain and behavior. In those days, the best tools we had were really only available in laboratory animals. We didn't have the kinds of imaging we have today for human studies. And so I spent about, as you mentioned before, Kathleen, about 20 years trying to understand what were the brain areas and the brain processes and the molecules most important for social behavior. And I was very interested not so much in the things that most people were studying back then, which would have been loss and stress and aggression, but kind of the flip side, the more positive aspects of social attachments, what goes into parental care, how is it that monogamy could exist in some species and not in others. And the lab that I developed at Emory University after working in the government for many years started to really focus on molecules like oxytocin and vasopressin, which we didn't know very much about in those days, and began to understand how that worked. Later on, I think David covers this a little bit in the story, I began to really think more about going back to where I started in psychiatry and ask, could this explosion of tools and insights into the brain and how it works, could we actually begin to use that to help people, which, as David mentioned, have these very serious and very common disorders? And so, returning to my roots as a physician and psychiatrist, in the early 2000s, went back into the National Institute of Mental Health and had the chance for 13 years to run the agency for the federal government that tries to bring together the best science, the best research to make a difference for people with these serious illnesses. Did that for quite a while, and it was a fantastic moment in time when the opportunities were there from genetics and neuroscience to really begin to understand what are these different illnesses, what's the cause, what's the mechanism, and what are the treatments going to be like. We had a range of medications, we had a range of psychotherapies, but I don't think anybody fully understood how they work or which treatments would be best for which individuals, and NIMH tried to attack that problem. I got to a point, though, where I began to feel that there were technologies that were emerging that might even be more powerful, and that's what led me to leave the NIMH back, it's been almost 2 years, initially to join Alphabet. In those days it was called Google, or Google Life Sciences, became part of a new company called Verily, which split off from Alphabet, or from Google, as an Alphabet company to really go after health issues. And then after being there for a year and a half, I got the itch to do my own company and scratching that with this new project, which is called MindStrong Health, here in Palo Alto, California.
Mm-hmm. And tell me just a little bit more. Well, let's introduce our other guest, which we haven't done yet, and he can tell us a little bit about how this technology has taken off in the field. David Baker is joining us from Australia, and he has done a very interesting study, Mental Health Smartphone Apps, Review and Evidence-Based Recommendations for Future Developments. And we thank you very much, David Baker, for being with us. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. So before, let's get an understanding, and then we'll find out how Tom is using the technology and hear from the other David as well. This technology to be able to treat mental illness is something that's brand new in the world, pretty much brand new. You've studied all of this. Is it new?
Yes, it's quite new now, obviously with the rise of smartphones. Computerized therapies, though, have been around for quite some time.
Oh.
And that's where the majority of the evidence comes from to support going forward onto the smartphone. So there's a lot of sort of internet-based therapies that have got some good evidence, and they've been really translated from evidence-based psychotherapies, so things like cognitive behavior therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy, and things like that. And now we're in the process, I think, at this point, of transferring some of the principles we learned from those therapies onto a mobile device. And that presents a whole lot of new and interesting challenges because people use their smartphones in very different ways to the way they use a computer, for instance. So many of these online therapies would be you sit down and do sort of lessons about like maybe half an hour at a time, over the course of a number of weeks, and people don't generally use their smartphones in the same way. So I think we're now starting to learn ways that people do use their smartphones, and also the many, many rich forms of data that can be collected from smartphones that can't be collected from laptops and computers, for example, and using those in new and innovative ways to help people and also to record important research data.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to the other David and to Tom on this. What kinds of data can be collected? David, let's go to you, David Dobbs. What your article outlines this. It's amazing what phones can gather about you.
It is. And it comes from the fact that you have your phone with you a lot. A lot of people have it pretty much on their body all the time.
Right.
And most people have one, use it a lot to communicate with people. So a few examples of behaviors that the phone naturally knows about because it's on you and it has accelerometers, it can detect motion and velocity and so on, are how much you move around and how quickly you move around, how much you, and all these things might change when you are, for instance, becoming depressed, or might change in another way if you were entering a psychotic period. So things like how often you respond to texts, emails, or phone calls from your friends, how often you reach out to them, how long your responses are, the kind of language you use in your response, all these things can be indicators. So can how much you move. Do you move around the house as much? Do you move around your neighborhood or town as much? Or do you stay still? How fast do you move? How fast do you pick up the phone? How fast do you speak? Do you speak really fast, or do you talk like you're depressed?
Mm.
All these things can be indicators that can, if someone, and I think Tom's program is like this, correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, if someone has opted into a system that tracks these and can give sort of an early warning to both you and people you have chosen to help look after you, then it could help solve one of these things that psychiatry struggles with so much, which is knowing when something's going awry with someone and reaching out quickly with help.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you want to add to
that? I probably left some things out.
Right. Tom?
No, I think it's a great summary. I think a good way to think about this, we started with the idea that you could use technology to deploy interventions, right? So forms of psychotherapy could be given through a laptop or a phone. This new era is a little different here. We're talking more about collecting information measurement, and the whole problem in psychiatry has been the lack of measurement. In diabetes, we look at sugar, and infectious diseases, we track somebody's body temperature, and heart disease, we've got a whole range of measures. But in psychiatry, it's behavior, and we aren't collecting behavior in a way that's objective or continuous. or even very comprehensive. So the phone gives us an opportunity to do that. And there's sort of two parts to it. One is, as David was just mentioning, some of the active measures you can get off a phone, like you can have people speak and you can collect changes in the way they talk and what they talk about. But there are a whole range of passive measurements. David mentioned some issues like location and activity, the metadata of texting out versus texting in, irrespective of what you actually say, just how often you do it, how quickly you respond, those kinds of things. There's also another set of measures, which is what we've been working on in MindStrong, which is kind of they're in the general category of human-computer interactions. So how do you address the keyboard? The latency with which you type, the number of errors when you type, the way in which you go from scroll to select. A lot of these are actually kind of real-world measures of how well you're thinking, of what your cognition is like. And we know that because when we've looked at large numbers of people where we've collected their keyboard performance data in the real world as they're just going about their daily life, we've also then given them a range of very rigorous neuropsychological tests. It's kind of extraordinary that what we're picking up off the phone is really very much the same as what we're trying to measure in the laboratory with a neuropsychological test. In fact, the neuropsychological tests in some ways are really just trying to get at what real-world performance is. Smartphone gives you real-world performance continually, ubiquitously, and passively. So that's pretty interesting, and it's a whole new opportunity, something that was never right. possible for us in the past.
I think you say in the article, David, it's not like it's Wednesday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the psychiatrist's office. How are you feeling at this point in time? You might be feeling very different Monday afternoon at 2:23, right?
Right. It's a constant read instead of the old joke is that, you know, a therapist knows how you're doing every Tuesday at 3 or something.
Right.
And there's an important point here, which is it's easy. Our culture is really in love with technology. And it's very possible to become reasonably skeptical, if not cynical, about mm-hmm. the promises that get made about tech. One of the things that attracted me to this story, there were two things. One was seeing how social connection through simple things like smartphones and email helped one person I know who became psychotic. It helped her recover and mm-hmm. pull herself together again. Mm-hmm. The other is that this is technology, but in a sense, this is pretty low tech. It's something everyone that is ubiquitous. So there's not a lot of money involved in getting the technology in hand, literally. And the things it measures are really not all that complicated. We're not doing brain scans. We're not doing invasive surgery. Yet the cumulative power of the data it collects is tremendous. And as Tom was saying, it reflects something real, not a proxy for something. It reflects actual behavior. So these are the things that, to me, suggest this has a lot of potential.
Mm-hmm. And then, Tom, what about the human element here? If somebody is feeling suicidal, is completely depressed, don't you have to make a connection somehow with somebody in the medical profession in order to treat that person? How do you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is only one piece. It's really the first piece is getting the detection or the prediction. What you really need to ask is, what do you do with that information then? How do you link somebody
yes.
to get the kind of care that really will make a difference? And that's probably where the use of smartphone technology separates out for psychiatry from what we would do in diabetes or heart disease or many other places, because so many of the interventions we care about in psychiatry are possible to deploy on a phone. You don't actually have to get somebody a particular surgical intervention or even a medication necessarily. So there's a lot you can do here. You can't do everything, but you can provide the kind of peer support that many people find life-saving. You can provide crisis intervention with a text or even with a phone call, although most people no longer use smartphones for calls. You could use it for that. It's mostly these days used for texting, and there are resources like Crisis Text Line that are available 24/7 at least within the United States, for anybody who finds themselves in a crisis, and you can get a response within a minute from somebody who's been trained to know how to respond. So there are a number of opportunities here that can build on the ubiquity of the technology. And of course, it's worth remembering that when we're talking about mental illnesses, these aren't really first world problems, or at least not exclusively
right.
first world problems. And for the first time, we have a technology that has a global reach and would allow us to provide resources to the developing world as easily as the developed world. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Let's talk about that global reach a little bit with our guest in Australia, David Baker. What is the reach? What does it make mental health accessibility available to people all over the world who probably don't have any mental health care, David?
Yes, absolutely. That's a massive advantage of these sorts of technologies. And also, even just to make these sorts of problems more visible, really. Even in Australia, 54% of people who experience mental health issues don't receive treatment, and that's a
goodness.
Really, really big statistic. That's
yes.
the majority of people. So we have fairly good mental health literacy and good mental health awareness here compared to other parts of the world. So definitely in other parts of the world, these sorts of issues aren't as visible, so people won't be going to seek treatment in the first place. So one of the big advantages of these technologies is they can reach out and get people, you know, in those states when they most need help, and really avoid a lot of the barriers that many traditional treatments will face. So things like, you know, actually going to and talking to your doctor about some of these issues are really actually quite scary. And they're even more scary if you're suffering from, you know, anxiety at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It can be even more anxiety-provoking. So we were actually sort of set up this system where the main form of treatment, the main form of therapy a lot of the time, is extremely scary and extremely hard to access in the first place. So using smartphones can break down a lot of those barriers to accessing those treatments, not just in countries like in the United States and America, and Australia, but all over the world, and also provide those treatments in more culturally sensitive contexts and in different languages and so forth. So there are a lot of advantages there.
Absolutely. I hadn't thought about all the languages. There is an element of it, Tom, and tell me if I'm reading this wrong, that sort of smacks of impersonality. I mean, when you're saying that somebody's receiving a text, that we text each other instead of a human being on the other end of the phone who has understanding of what we're going through and can talk to us, really, are we going to just not talk now and text?
Well, sometimes texting can also be quite personal, so it's in some ways maybe gives you even a little more time to respond rather than using voice, which is in real time. But I get your point that you don't want this to be done by a robot or by a bot. At least most people don't. What I think is important to remember, though, is that there comes with that an anonymity, which
right.
Some people might find offensive, but for other people, it actually is a bit of safety. Many people have said that one of the biggest problems in getting mental health care is the stigma around that and the concern that people have that they will be identified in some way. Groups like Alcoholics Anonymous have grown up because they give people the both social connection and the anonymity at the same time, so that there's some safety associated with that. You can do that online even better, and you can do it at scale in a way that AA could never do because it requires people being in the same room at the same time. But imagine a virtual AA that would have hundreds of thousands of participants coming together to share similar problems and how they've solved them, and helping others through mentoring and through sponsorship to be able to recover. There's just a lot of potential here that we're just beginning to tap.
Mm-hmm.
If I can add
of
something
course.
Here, there is it's hard to try to imagine how this could all play out in a given system, and in the story I write about a couple of examples of this that are centered really the center of them is peer support, and the professional help is on the periphery, sort of on call, as it were. And one of them was a pilot program called Prime, run by a former colleague at Verily of Tom's, Daniel Schlosser, who created this is for people who had to join this group, and it's roughly, very roughly, like a Facebook group. I use that because it's familiar to people, that people were invited to join and join. And what they had in common was that they had all been diagnosed with a first psychotic episode. And some were, I believe most were recovered, but they were at higher statistical risk of entering another period. These are people who understood each other. They had all been through what is often an extremely traumatic experience in our culture, and they now had a group of people that they could communicate with at will, openly but privately, as mm-hmm. it were, and get their support. And this is tremendously important for people who struggle with serious mental health. There's such a stigma. People who've suffered from depression on and off for years are reluctant to confess it. And with psychosis, it's five times as bad. The first thing that happens when you become psychotic is your social network disintegrates almost overnight. This is a system that can give at least a partial replacement to those kind of networks that is safe. And again, there's one person I know who's psychotic. I wrote about this person. It'll come out later. I can't really talk about the story yet. But this happened to her. Her social network completely fell apart. She rebuilt one mainly online that was an absolutely vital lifeline for her to recover. And if phones can be used in a way that are roughly like this program, that have similarities, some of the aspects that Schlosser's program has it, where there's a built-in kind of informal but closed peer group, I think that, to me, is one of the greatest potential strengths of this, because it gives people a place for support, care, and understanding, which are, along with professional help often, the things that are most vital and most helpful to them.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. The question of the hour is, well, we're learning about this technology, but we're finding the technology has the potential to make mental health care pretty accessible and obviously less expensive. We're talking about what we can do and what is being done with smartphones, the information that can be gathered on a real-time basis to detect the onset of a mental illness episode, to get help more immediately and to provide support. This is all outlined in a really interesting article in The Atlantic for this month, The Smartphone Psychiatrist. Frustrated by the failures in his field, Tom Insel, who's one of our guests, as is the author of this piece, a former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, is now trying to reduce the world's anguish through the devices in people's pockets. Our phone number for all of our guests, Tom Insel, is with us, and he left the National Institute of Mental Health for Google's Life Sciences Research Organization. Most recently, he founded the mental health startup MindStrong Health. Also with us is David Baker, and he's in Melbourne, Australia, where he's a doctor of clinical psychology candidate and a provisional psychology at Monash University in Melbourne. And David Dobbs, who writes about science and culture for The Atlantic, National Geographic. He wrote a profile of Tom that appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. Phone calls 800-486-8655 for any questions you have about this technology or thoughts you have about its effectiveness, whether or not you would recommend that you, if you are recommend to somebody you know who may be suffering from mental illness, and many people do at some point in their lives, or if it's something you would consider for yourself. What do you think? What do you need to know about it? We welcome phone calls, and we'll start taking them in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls, many coming in for our guests. We start with Stephanie in Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Kathleen, and hi to your guest. Kathleen, by the way, make this really quick. Oh, I'm going to miss you, but I'm so glad you're retiring.
Thanks, Stephanie.
You bet. All right, so your guest. This is really wonderful. First of all, I am a woman I've become blind over the last number of years, and the tech, the smartphone technology and computer technology is becoming more and more blind friendly, but this is going to be a godsend for a lot of people because one of the things that people who are blind use, there are phone lines. They're kind of analogous to, I think of it as being online, but, you know, there's ways for blind people to connect, and there's also more and more computer friendliness, and the smartphones are becoming way more accessible. But there's a lot of people out there that are seeking counseling, seeking mental health, different types of mental health assistance. I personally benefited. I'm here in Madison, and I took a 10-week mindfulness. It was basically a group therapy slash. It was a mindfulness class run by two psychiatrists, but there are group therapy elements, and it was covered by insurance because it was directed towards people who have had anxiety or depression. It was a godsend. I mean, I'm not kidding how much it helped me. So having this technology, making sure is accessible to people who are blind, visually mm-hmm. impaired, and other disabilities. There is the National Federation for the Blind has been really out there in terms of technology accessibility. They'd be good people to be in contact with. There's an American Council for the Blind, ACB, that's another excellent consumer group. So with that, guys, unless you have any questions for me, I'm going
to
hang up.
All right, Stephanie, thank you very much. And let's give this to Tom and to David in Australia, if this technology exists for people like Stephanie. Tom?
I'm not an expert on that.
All right. But
I think it's important to remember, these are early days. You know, think about this. iPhone was introduced just a decade ago, and we're still trying to figure out where it's going and what could be done. I don't think we know enough about the effectiveness, the clinical usefulness of a lot of this. So this is still, we're still at kind of an experimental point in terms of many of the both measurements that we've got and the interventions that we've got as well. So it's early days. We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, David Baker, how much do you know about how it's going to play out and its effectiveness?
Yeah, I think I absolutely agree with Tom. We're at this point where we're just sort of finding out what works and what doesn't. Mindfulness, as Nicole mentioned, is something that smartphones are generally strong at in these early days because there are lots of mindfulness apps available. But, again, the evidence for those is not rock solid right now. We just don't know, I suppose, at this point. But we do know that smartphones are very good at deploying a lot of audio files in line. So that's essentially what a lot of these mindfulness apps can be. You can just put some headphones in and listen to a mindfulness meditation, and it can guide you through that. And there are a number of different programs that it can guide you through. So lots of apps like Headspace or Smiling Minds or 10% Happier and these sorts of things that people can use on their phones. And also when they're not necessarily experiencing significant periods of anxiety or depression or other mental health issues, everyone can use mindfulness in some way or shape or form. So that will be an interesting area going forward with the research.
Mm-hmm. David Dobbs, how long will it take to get a substantial body of research to know about the effectiveness?
Oh, goodness, that's a hard question. I understand that MindStrong is running a few trials over the next year to see if some of the algorithms they use to collect and process information from smartphones match up with actual movements in patients' mental health. Correct me if I have that wrong, Tom. I think it'll take a while, but it might be faster than other realms of mental health research that take years or decades to show whether they're effective.
Well, Tom, you must have faith in it or you wouldn't be doing it, right?
I have faith. I think it's interesting. I think there's a lot of potential, but there are a lot of questions we have to answer. So when I got involved, I thought, gosh, this should be a really great way to measure improvements or worsening of depression when somebody is struggling with that illness, until I realized that a lot of people, when they're depressed, stop using their phones altogether or they won't charge their phones. And so it's not trivial to actually make that jump from it's a good idea, and it seems like it should give us a lot of great information to actually figuring out what it will do in the real world and how well it will change clinical outcomes. That we don't know. Whether it will reduce suicide, we don't know that. Mm-hmm. Whether it will actually give us less hospitalization, these are all the things we're studying right now. And I think within 18 months, we'll have a much better sense of the value of this approach. We also have to think about a lot of issues around trust and making sure that people feel comfortable with this kind of measurement. For some people, it will feel like surveillance.
Yes.
And some people are going to worry about privacy. And we have to really make sure we've got all of those issues well in hand and we've thought about them ahead of time and not when there's a crisis around the misuse of somebody's data.
Stephanie, thanks for your call. Evie in Delaview. Hi. Are you there?
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead.
Hi. I didn't know if you could hear me very well. Just because this is exciting.
I'm sorry, Evie. Your phone is just not working very well, so please give us a ring back. And I guess that's a question that we have, too. Sometimes our phones don't work very well, right? Do we need an improvement in the technology of our cell phones occasionally? David?
That was a nice illustration of the gap that can arise between potential and delivery.
Exactly.
I think something that maybe I haven't stressed enough here is that the history of psychiatry is the history of struggle to do something very hard. And there have been many times when we thought we had a solution that would help everyone efficiently and cheaply. And it hasn't panned out. There's been lots of progress, but as Tom has related in some of his talks, psychiatry and mental health care have not seen the sort of big breakthroughs that really show statistically in a pretty way on decrease in mortality and illness that we've seen in heart disease, for instance. It's still struggling. This is one that part of the thing that seems most promising here or full of potential is how cheap it is and how ubiquitous it is to put it in everyone's hands. There's a lot to get right and a lot to screw up between here and making it work. And I don't know how that's going to go. I hope it goes well. Part of what interests me here is on a sort of historical arc, Tom's career, this is part of why I wrote about him, it reflects a lot of changes in psychiatry and mm-hmm. what we're willing to try, both as an institution of psychiatry and as a culture. And this seems a real change from some other ways that have paid off less. And it's interesting in that right. It's fascinating. I hate to overpromise it because it's going to be hard and it might or might not work.
Yeah, it sure is different. Why is psychiatry still struggling, Tom?
It's a hard problem. You know, when you think about illnesses like psychosis or severe depression, I think we can all agree that these in some way involve brain circuits that aren't working well, but we don't have the tools to look at brain circuitry the way we have tools that can really visualize the heart or visualize the various aspects of the GI system or the liver or other areas of the body. It's very hard to biopsy the brain and know what's happening in any given part of it, at least at the speed of thought, the way that you'd really want. So this is just going to be difficult to get to. We can try to estimate what's happening through talking to people and observing behavior, but that may only get us so far. So it has been difficult to be able to make the progress that we have made in other parts of medicine. Ironically, we do have pretty good treatments, and those haven't been recent, but medications and therapies that have been around for a long time do seem to be very helpful. We don't know quite how they work. We don't always know who they're going to work best for, but we have something to offer. It's also been a problem in this field in being able to get the treatments to the people who really need them. And I think right. there, the part of the issue is that when you're depressed or when you're psychotic, you aren't looking for care usually. When you're depressed, you're hopeless and helpless, and you don't think it's worth it. And when you're psychotic, you probably don't think you have a problem, or you may not think you're ill. That's part of the illness. And so that also gets in the way of our being able to actually make public health progress on illnesses for which we have pretty good treatments.
Mm-hmm. I think that our guest from Australia made a striking comment when he said that 64% of people in Australia who need mental health treatment don't get treatment. That's a huge number. Let's go next to Amy in Sheboygan. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm calling to ask your guests if they have heard of a group that is online. It's called In the Room. And this is all over the world, and they are based on Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And you can do Narcotics Anonymous, alcohol. They have sex addict groups. And they run virtually 24/7. There will be a meeting on the hour. So people can get together, use their camera on their screen or their computer or phone, so you can show your face and talk to the group, or you can be totally anonymous and use a nickname and not show your face. But they are held just like an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. They have leaders who are trained, and it's a way to address that social networking breakdown that people go through when they're having problems. I've wondered if they've heard of that or could use that for their research.
David Dobbs, have you?
I have not come across that. In the Room, it's called, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. No, thanks. I'll check it out. A quick Google turns up something else. It's not fit for radio. But
oh, dear.
A movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I'll check that out. And that's the sort of thing that I was referring to earlier that can be such help to people.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom, are you familiar with that? Or David?
I don't know that one. The one that I'm more familiar with is called Seven Cups. David writes about that
yes.
in an article. That's one that has gone viral. They're up to, I think, 1 million users a month at this point, and creating different kinds of communities, some of which would be like in the rooms, maybe substance abuse related, but many of them are completely unrelated to substance abuse, but just people who are struggling with specific issues, and they find each other. It's global. They come together in an anonymous kind of on-demand way, and work together to help solve each other's problems. It's kind of interesting because, like AA, what they're doing really is empowering people not only by giving them solutions, but giving them the opportunity to help somebody else with a similar problem. And that's a profoundly important thing to be able to do.
And how about in Australia? David Baker, are you familiar with any programs like In the Room or Seven Cups?
Yes, yeah, I'm familiar with those apps, but again, the research on them is not entirely clear, which is sort of concerning that these are things that are out there and that they're being used, and obviously from personal experience of a lot of people, they're helpful, but we haven't answered those research questions yet. And it's also concerning, especially because it's relatively easy to measure whether these things can be helpful or not on a digital platform, because the data collection is much easier than for example, face-to-face studies. But it does require a little bit more from the users. For example, they might have to complete some questionnaires or participate in some other way rather than just getting the service completely clean. So there's a little bit more friction for the users, but I think it's really important going forward for these sorts of digital mental health companies to consider building into their interventions some way to collect some research data on the effectiveness on what they're giving to people, because then, you know, a few years down the track, they might be able to publish that research, and then we'll actually know whether it is very helpful or not.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. And we're talking about the use of technology, particularly smartphones, having the potential to make mental health care cheaper and more accessible. Is it effective? Where are we with all of this? We have three very interesting guests, and we'll return to them and to you in a moment on the Ideas Network. Tawny is next in Madison. Hi, Tawny.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have, I struggle, and it is a huge stigma as far as, you know, even finding a job, or if you're on disability, you don't want to, you know, how you put it on your application. But what I have a real, the question I have has nothing to do with the technology, but I was wondering what the guests are thinking about ECTs. And another thing is that I wanted to say sometimes people with mental illness are afraid of the phone. So I don't know. I just thought I'd just put that out
yes.
for you guys.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Do you want to give a comment, Tom, on electroshock?
Yeah, it's probably the most stigmatized of treatments within psychiatry, and yet it's also perhaps the most effective. The treatment today is used mostly for people who haven't responded to medications or psychotherapy. But the numbers are quite interesting. About 70% of people respond to ECT, which is much higher than the rate of response to either medication or psychotherapy for those with severe forms of depression. So I think it's an important tool within the tool shed that psychiatrists have. It's not used very often, but it's used mostly for people with severe depression who don't respond to anything else. And in fact, it should give all of us an enormous amount of hope because it is so effective for the people who really need it.
Hmm. And what about her comment to you, I guess, as well, Tom, that people who may be suffering from depression or mental illness don't want to use the phone?
Well, I don't think we know enough about that. I think one of the questions we're trying to get a handle on is what happens when people become ill in terms of the way that they connect to technology and social media. For a lot of people, I completely agree with your caller. They socially isolate. And as I mentioned before, often people with depression stop charging their phones. They stop using them. But it's an important reminder that, as David said, we've had lots of great ideas in this field, and many of them have not really fulfilled their promise. That may be one of the things that gets in the way here as well. We'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. And, David, when will we see? What's being done now that you know of, and when are we going to see how effective this will be?
I'm not quite in a position to say, but my best guess would be that in certainly the next 2 to 5 years, optimistically on the two side, pessimistically on the five, we should see data from groups that are trying to do this. As I said, MindStrong is trying to evaluate their data collection, their system for assessing it through smartphones with... Tom, am I correct in my memory that you're doing this with actual patients, that and this is a collaboration with clinicians so that you can compare what your phone data would predict or track with the patient's actual record?
Right. There's several efforts like this. They have to make the jump from academic research to large-scale clinical practice. I think we know that within the domain of academic research, there's something quite promising and helpful here. But whether that makes the jump to the millions of people who need better mental health care, I don't know that we've got that answer yet. We'll have much more information about the value of this within the next 9 months, no question about that. And we are doing now large-scale projects for people who are not in academic centers but who are out in general practice. We'll get some of that data this year, more of it next year. I think we'll know by the end of 2018, a lot more than we do right now about the overall value, at least for the measurement side. Certainly on the intervention side, we've had lots of studies that have been done, as you already heard, that demonstrate the value of doing interventions on the phone that look to be at least equivalent to, in some cases, better than what you can do face-to-face.
That's interesting. And on that, we have to say goodbye. Thank you all so much. It was really a fascinating article and conversation. Thanks for doing the article, David. It was really well done.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, thank you. And Tom,
thanks,
thank
Kathleen.
You. Thank you very much. David in Australia, thank you.
Thanks very much, Kathleen.
Yeah, our thanks. Tom Insel was director of the National Institute of Mental Health. He is now founder of the mental health startup MindStrong. David Dobbs writes about this in The Atlantic. We'll put it on our Facebook page. And David Baker, a doctor of clinical psychology in Melbourne, Australia. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening and for your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock.